This is WHYY.
I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. Tonight at 9 o'clock, on the eve of the 13th anniversary of the September 11th terror attacks, President Obama is laying out his strategy to stop the advance of the terrorist group known as the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS, or ISIL. Obama gave a bit of a preview about what he was going to say when talking with host Chuck Todd on Meet the Press this past Sunday.
What I want people to understand, though, is that over the course of months, we are going to be able to not just blunt the momentum of ISIL, we are going to systematically degrade their capabilities, we're going to shrink the territory that they control, and ultimately we're going to defeat them.
Obama met with congressional leaders yesterday about his plan, which is not without serious risks. He campaigned in 2008 on getting out of the war in Iraq, and earlier this year dismissed ISIS as a minor threat. Today we talk about the president's options, the state of terrorism then and now, and whether defeating ISIS is even possible. And we have two guests who have joined us. Brian Katulis, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where his work focuses on U.S. national security policy in the Middle East and South Asia. Brian, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be with you, Marty.
Also with us is Rami Khoury, director of the Isham Ferris Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs. That's at the American University of Beirut. He's also editor-at-large and columnist at the Beirut-based Daily Star newspaper. And Rami Khoury, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks. Glad to be with you, especially after the Eagles won.
Don't distract us from our conversation there, Rami.
Another war, exactly.
Brian, let me go to you, and even using some of the words that the president used on Meet the Press about blunting ISIS, degrading, and even defeating them, ultimately, he used the language ultimately, which I thought was interesting. Can ISIS be defeated, do you think?
Well, we just released a paper this morning called Defeating ISIS, so I believe they can be, but the U.S. can't do it. And I think, as your other guest, Rami, has written very articulately, ISIS is the product of forces in the region, a generation of leaders that have failed their people, the autocrats, the dictators, those who have not respected the basic rights and needs of their own citizens. So the U.S. can't defeat it itself. And I think the interesting thing to watch for in tonight's speech by President Obama is I suspect he'll continue to heavily stress the need for the people of the region, as well as governments in the region, but stress the people as well, to defeat this, because ultimately a dangerous group like this doesn't come from nowhere. It's the product of these complex social, demographic, economic, and political forces. So the U.S. might take some more military action here, but this is an administration that wants to clearly avoid the mistakes that were made in George W. Bush's global war on terror. And one of the biggest mistakes was making it all about us rather than about the region itself.
Brian, let me just look at the headline in the New York Times this morning, or perhaps it was yesterday, Obama ready to authorize airstrikes on ISIS in Syria. I mean, if I'm reading the article and the headline correctly, it sounds as if the president is poised to take some kind of military action.
I think that's right, but I think he will heavily condition upon other actors in the region working with him. I mean, look, had he struck against ISIS in early June, when a lot of the hawks and neoconservatives demanded that he do, before Prime Minister Maliki of Iraq stepped down, we would have been seen to be backing a very sectarian leader. Now, we're on the pathway to getting a different leader, and I think it's a serious question as to whether the new Prime Minister of Iraq, Abadi, will be substantially different than Maliki. But what we have here is a different conception. If George W. Bush said, when the Iraqis stand up, we'll stand down, which basically put the onus on us, President Obama is essentially saying, if there are Iraqis and then Syrians who will fight for their country cohesively, we'll offer some limited support, but it's not going to be open-ended and it will be very targeted, but it's going to be heavily dependent on cohesive actions by actors in the region themselves. Easier said than done, though.
Well, indeed. And let me turn to you, Rami Khoury. And I know there was a meeting of the Arab League just a couple of days ago. Do you see regional interest in cooperating and trying to defeat ISIS one way or the other?
Well, I think for sure. ISIS is basically fighting with everybody in the region, and literally everybody, Arab governments, Iran, Turkey, Israel, the U.S., Shiites, Sunnis, Kurds, Alawites, they're really out to do whatever they have to do to create their own Islamic State, as they call it. And therefore, everybody in the region is threatened by them, and everybody would like to do something about them. But there's a big problem, which is most of these Arab governments and some of the other ones are pretty incompetent in terms of taking action together. The Arab League is a joke as an institution. Unfortunately, I wish it was better. It's not a serious institution. They just make statements that people like, but they should be completely discounted. The countries in the Arab world that have power, military power, like Saudi Arabia, Jordan to a smaller extent, Egypt, UAE has been throwing its military planes around, bombing in Libya. Some of them could get involved militarily if they wanted to, but none of them seem to be willing or anxious to do that, and they will find ways to help out by providing training facilities or money or backup services or something. So we have really leaderships in the Arab world that just will not take the lead on this, and they will follow the U.S., and they will find cover under Security Council resolutions or Arab League statements. So there'll be a patching up of some kind of very loose coalition. I wouldn't even use the word a coalition. Kerry and Obama should have thought of a better word, not to repeat George W. Bush's coalition. But there should be a better way to find Arab participation in the military action. Now, the lead has to be taken by the Iraqis, of course. The Iraqi government has to take the lead, and that will probably allow some of the other countries in the region, including Iran, which is not Arab, but that supports many of the Iraqis, the Shiites especially, and Iran will get involved. So I think there will be just enough participation by different Middle Eastern countries. The Turks might do something. But it's going to be, you have to pull them dragging and screaming into getting involved in a serious military operation, and that's why the U.S. has to take the lead. The problem for the U.S. is when it takes the lead, both in the military action and in the political coalition building, it proves the total incompetence and even lack of legitimacy of many of the local governments in the eyes of their own people, because most people in the Arab world don't trust the United States, and they don't like to see it taking military action. The other problem is that the U.S. Leading a coalition of Arab autocrats and using militarism as the leading American instrument is precisely how these jihadi Islamist militant groups came into being, whether it was Qaeda in the 80s and 90s or Islamic State, ISIS, or then Islamic State. They all came out of this combination of American militarism and Arab autocracy. Before that, it was Russian militarism in Afghanistan, of course. So any foreign military force in the region is going to breed this kind of, elicit this kind of response from some of these extremist groups. So there are real, real constraints here and complications. You know, Obama's a lot more sophisticated and intelligent and careful than George W. Bush was, but I'm kind of worried that he's essentially applying the same approach. And this talk of we're going to degrade them and contain them and blunt them is completely, completely against the realities of modern history, where American military action creates zones of chaos, creates political resentments, and creates a demand for revenge, which allows these groups to grow rather than to shrink. So this is a real challenge.
Well, indeed, and you put a number of things on the table there, Rami. Let me go back to you, Brian, and both of you have actually talking about, obviously, the complexity of the situation, the risk of unintended consequences. But can the United States and even the region, though, tolerate this terrorist group that has taken large swaths of land in both Syria and Iraq? Can they, with designs, I think, even further than that, can the region, can the world tolerate their victories on the ground?
Well, I think we've reached a breaking point where it's quite obvious the answer is no. And I think I'd put first and foremost the people of Iraq and Syria at the forefront there, because they're the ones that have suffered the most. And when you see the brutal atrocities, I mean, we all as Americans here were shocked by the murders of the two journalists last month. But that's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of what this group has been doing to Iraqis and Syrians of all walks of life, Christian, Muslim. And their crimes against humanity are enormous.
Yes.
So I just think we've reached a tipping point, and much of what Rami said offers, I think, very useful cautions about how to proceed or how not to proceed. The question, you know, I often have when I've read his pieces and just listened to him is then what do we do about it? Because essentially this group, combined with other extremist groups, let's not forget Jabhat al-Nusra, which is the al-Qaeda affiliate inside of Syria, have essentially broken down an order that was already creaking, an order that was probably bound to collapse in Syria and Iraq. And it's a disorder that we have that, first and foremost, is a problem for the region. I think President Obama's top counterterrorism and intelligence officials have been saying quite clearly we have no evidence of a live potential threat from ISIS at this point to American homeland security. And I think they've been very measured. And that, again, you contrast that to George W. Bush raising alert terrors at a moment's notice, terror alerts at a moment's notice. There is sort of this judicious, deliberative approach. The key question then, it goes back to where I think Rami and I largely agree, is that this is a problem, first and foremost, the region must wrestle with. The U.S. can offer some support and some leadership here. And here I wouldn't be... have any rose-colored glasses about what the leaders of the region or the people themselves will be able to do without some form of outside support. And I think that's the tricky thing is, you know, whether it's a coalition or some sort of motley pickup team of people who oppose ISIS, you're going to see a counter-reaction to ISIS's actions in the next few months. The question is whether that's constructive, whether it's as organized as it can be. It's not going to be perfect, but I think a response is coming.
Rami, about a minute before our first break here, but do you think it's even possible that ISIS could be its own worst enemy? And by that, as you both have described, I mean, everybody hates ISIS in the region, and I can't imagine anyone actually wants to live underneath their form of control, that either people will rise up against it or it will sort of explode of its own making.
Well, I don't think it'll explode of its own making. They've been pretty good at taking control of some territory, being patient, starting in Iraq, then going to Syria, setting up a base, and then developing income sources, and then expanding back into Iraq. So they're very patient. You know, each one of these, each generation of these jihadi militants learns from the experiences of the ones before them. And these guys are doing something a little bit different than others. So they're quite strong right now, but they're very thin. They have not been confronted with a serious military pushback by anybody yet, other than these American strikes in northeastern Iraq and a few grand Kurdish forces. But when you get an organized military attack against them in Iraq or Syria, I believe they will fall back very quickly.
Hold on to that thought, only because we have to take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation, talking with Rami Khoury and Brian Katulis about ISIS and President Obama's speech tonight. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia opens its 50th anniversary concert season on September 14th and 15th at the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts. Music director Dirk Brasset conducts the orchestra in beloved works by Verdi and Beethoven and welcomes pianist Dee Wu for Mendelssohn's Piano Concerto No. 2. Tickets available now at chamberorchestra.org or 215-893-1709. That's chamberorchestra.org or 215-893-1709.
This Week in This American Life.
You got to tighten up your story.
Our longtime producer Alex Bloomberg is trying to start his own business, and he is recording the entire awkward process, like when a billionaire investor who he's pitching gives up any pretense that he might invest and just starts coaching him.
We'll start again. So
you're
uniquely positioned to do it because you're better at it than anybody?
Yeah, I am.
I apologize for that.
Yeah. This Week.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. You know the type, the guy who sees the merge right sign on the highway and stays in the left lane anyway to cut ahead.
While everybody else who's already in the lane that has merged looks to their left and growls and grimaces. But as it turns out, there are a lot of people who think that you actually should go all the way to the end.
That's the zipper merge. Then there's the jerk merge. We'll debate both next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Tonight at 9 o'clock, on the eve of the 13th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, President Obama will be laying out his strategy to combat the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, known as ISIS. The president calls them ISIL. Talking with Brian Katula, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and Rami Khoury joining us from Beirut. He's director of the Issam Faris Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs. That's at the American University of Beirut. He's also editor-in-large and columnist at the Beirut-based Daily Star newspaper. Brian Katulis's work focuses on U.S. national security policy in the Middle East and also South Asia. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. What do you want President Obama to say? What do you want him to do? Brian, turning back to you, and from both you and from Rami, I hear a great deal of caution, obviously, about the unintended consequences. But I also hear you both saying is that there has to be some kind of military approach, military strategy in dealing with ISIS. At least from you, Brian, am I hearing you correctly?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, if you take a look at this report we put out today, we're not sort of advocating solely U.S. military action or military action by actors in the region. It needs to be nested in a broader strategy that deals with these political issues that Rami talks about, especially in Iraq, but then also in Syria. So quite clearly, ISIS has been punching above its weight and using propaganda and using its atrocities to get into our mindset, and we need to be careful about how we respond to it. I think the most effective thing we can do is try to work with reliable and capable partners on the ground that are willing to fight for their country. We see that in certain aspects in the Kurdish Peshmerga in northern Iraq. They've been willing to fight and be, you know, on the ground against ISIS, which is quite a contrast to the Iraqi security forces in Mosul and other places that essentially stripped off their uniforms and handed over their weapons. So, yes, there needs to be, I think there's no reconciling with some of these actors. There's no way we can sit down, I think, anyone and get them to change their way.
So you're saying diplomacy with ISIS is not an option?
No, not at all. I mean, but diplomacy with those that give safe harbor, that have funded and given money to these groups, and there are some of these groups, some of them allegedly our best friends in the Gulf, have allowed some of the money that these groups have gotten, not only ISIS, but Jabhat al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda affiliate. There's clear evidence that, you know, these oil-rich countries where we have U.S. military bases have played this double game with us. So diplomacy with those folks and essentially saying, you know, you've got a choice here and stop playing this game because you're essentially destroying your region of the world, and you're creating the security threat for all of us. I think that's warranted. But, you know, military action, again, and I think Rami has a very good point about how U.S. military action is perceived, especially after Bush's global war on terror. So it needs to be sort of nested, used very, very targeted in a targeted way, in a precise way, not an open-ended way. But it has to be nested in a political framework that simply doesn't really exist yet in Iraq. They're trying to get it together and is completely obliterated by the chaos in Syria.
Well, let me ask you about Syria, Rami. Let me turn to you. I mean, it's complicated enough. The U.S., I think, has launched something like 145 or maybe even more airstrikes against ISIS in Iraq in support of the ground troops there, not American ground troops, but local ground troops. Looking at Syria, if the United States is to bomb or attack ISIS on the ground there, is it possible to do that without empowering, for instance, Assad?
It's a very tricky process to navigate. The U.S. basically wants to defeat Assad and to defeat the Islamic State and to help the other sort of secular or mild Islamist, centrist Islamist opposition groups to prevail along with the Kurds in Syria. It's not very easy to do, and the problem in Syria is much more complicated than in Iraq. The thing about this situation in both Iraq and Syria, there just absolutely is no quick, easy, logical answer. This problem has been building up over the last 40 or 50 years due to many reasons. Brian mentioned at the beginning that the Arab autocracy, in which I had mentioned in my columns, is clearly, I'd argue, the biggest one, but we also have the foreign exchange and military interventions in the region, the Arab-Israeli conflict spillover. Many, many things came together, and including environmental stress and mismanagement of natural resources. So we got here over 40, 50 years of bad policies. We're not going to get out of it very quickly. The military role of the United States clearly is going to be very important in a very short-term targeted way that complements the local taking the lead on both political state building and military pushback against the Islamic State. So there has to be an American role. I think everybody accepts that. My guess is that throwing the Islamic State out of Iraq is going to be easier than doing finding a solution in Syria. And people don't want to do business with Bashar al-Assad. They want to overthrow him, Americans as well as local people. And therefore, there has to be a kind of a two-pronged or three-pronged war, which is attack the Islamic State, keep isolating and pressuring Assad, and help the secular Islamist mainstream middle opposition to get stronger. That's a very difficult balancing act, but it's doable if this opposition, the mainstream opposition, can be helped quickly. It can be done, but there's no signs of that happening. So, again, we're in for a long haul, and the United States should be careful that whatever it does is sustainable only in the context of strong local participation politically and militarily and in terms of state building.
Well, Brian, and picking up on the long haul that Rami just referred to, according to polls, at least more, pretty recent polls, there seems to be public support in the United States for some kind of military approach or attack, I guess, on ISIS, probably because of the beheading of the two American journalists. But are Americans ready for the long haul if this and President Obama seemed to even indicate that this could be a several year operation?
I don't think they're prepared just yet. And I think that this speech tonight is largely focused on that. It's largely focused on defining what this threat represents. And, if you remember right after the 9/11 attacks almost 13 years ago, there was a lot of talk about this battle of ideas, a lot of talk about how we can't just do this militarily with military action. And that was quickly forgotten in 2003 when the Bush administration went into Iraq mistakenly, I believe. And I think what we're seeing is a reemergence of that, that this, again, requires a multifaceted strategy that, yes, there'll be some military measures, some security measures that the U.S. and other countries need to take. But without the other things that we should have learned from the mistakes of the global war on terror, without ending these bargains with dictators and autocrats in the region, in the Middle East. And that's I think, still very important because it fosters and breeds this resentment at a popular level. Without countering these very dangerous radical ideologies based on a distorted interpretation of religion, all of that requires a different type of engagement by the U.S. And, I think the U.S. can play a quiet leadership role here, but it's first and foremost going to be about prodding the leaders and then the people of the region to fight this fight, to actually, when these atrocities happen, stand up and decry them, and then also offer an alternative ideology, which is virtually non-existent in the Middle East right now. I mean, you have Islamism and you have some vestiges of Arab nationalism, but you've got a lot of xenophobia and strong nationalism, but not, no political ideology in the sense that we have here in our country of center, left, and right. And that, I think, is the only way to defeat these groups is politically. But you got to have people, political leaders, who actually have an idea in the region how to do that.
Well, and I'm thinking of the Arab Spring and sort of this call for more freedoms, more democracy, or an actual democracy. And Brian, I mean, look at the region today.
Yeah, the scorecard doesn't look too good. But there are some hopeful signs in places like Tunisia, where there's still a negotiated process going on. Egypt looks quite awful because it's backslid and back into this nationalist sort of divided country. But the thing is, Marty, I see the region, when you look at simple demographics, and the vast majority of people are under the age of 25 or 30, change is coming no matter what. And the question is whether the people of the region and that next generation continue to fight against the old ways of doing business, and whether we support them, or whether we do the old ways of business, which I think Rami has argued, I've argued in my work, really haven't served U.S. interests and haven't really brought sustainable security to the region itself.
That's Brian Katula, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Also with us, Rami Khoury. He's with the American University in Beirut, also a columnist and editor-at-large at the Daily Star newspaper, which is based in Beirut. We are talking about ISIS. We are talking about the fact that the president will be speaking to the nation tonight to outline his strategy to combat ISIS. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Rami, you're joining us from Beirut there, and what is the mood or the sense on the ground in Lebanon about ISIS, about whether people feel a threat from this terrorist organization?
Yes, it's a big topic. It's the main topic of discussion of any political discussion, private or public, in the region for the last 2 or 3 months. And people in Lebanon are having to deal with a problem in the northeast border with Syria, where Jabhat al-Nusra groups and other Islamist militants, some of them close to the Islamic State, some of them separate but following a similar ideology, have been attacking in Lebanon across the border. They kidnapped 18 Lebanese soldiers. They have them now held hostage. They killed two of them. They're chopping their heads off. So there is a direct problem, threat in Lebanon. People are worried about it. The response from Lebanon has been actually quite positive, because the army and Hezbollah, which are the two biggest, most powerful military groups, are now working very closely together with foreign intelligence, including America, and helping them out, because everybody is threatened by these movements, the Islamic State-type movements. Therefore, people are worried about it, but they feel a little bit more confident when they see Hezbollah and the army working relatively effectively to push them back. If I could just add another quick point to what I said before, that when the Islamic State is confronted with a coordinated military response, I think they will be pushed back very quickly. That'll be easy to do. The thing to keep in mind about them is they have no real anchorage in society. They have these groups, IS and people like them, have only been able to grow around the region, and they've grown all over the region, in Somalia and Yemen and Nigeria and Libya. And, so they've popped up all over the place, but they've only been able to emerge when there's chaos and lack of governability. And this is what American militarism does, or foreign militarism, like the Soviets in Afghanistan. It brings zones of chaos. It opens the opportunity for these characters to set up shop, and they set up shop, and then they terrorize people, and then they have a little territory to control. But they have no anchorage among the population. They've been trying for 25 years. Ayman al-Zawahiri and Bin Laden tried to get popular Arab support, but their message doesn't resonate with people. People think these guys are kooky, nutty, violent thugs. So they can only rule by force. And the real danger is that if you get enough Arab autocracy and foreign militancy together in the region, that will so upset some Sunnis especially that they will say, like, you know, I'd rather have the Islamic State give me a peaceful, quiet place than to have these old Arab autocrats and American soldiers ruin my life or kill me. So this is the real dilemma, that the longer they stay in place, they might be able to build up some kind of base where people don't gladly, happily root for them, but they'll say, look, ISIS is better than, you know, Maliki, the prime minister of Iraq, used to be, or Bashar al-Assad in Syria. This is the real dilemma that they're facing. But I think they're going to be defeated over time simply because they don't have a base, but they'll only be defeated when the local Sunnis particularly rise up against them and the central government offers all of the people of Syria and Iraq
Brian,
a better
word. Yeah, Brian, a couple of minutes before we have to say goodbye. Does the president have to tell the American people how this would be in their interest to use his words, degrade and destroy ISIS?
Yes. The president, I think, over the past year, when he talks about national security, has not discussed clearly enough the how and the why. And the why is the thing that I would stress the most. If you recall his West Point speech in May, I believe it was, when he talked about his vision for national security, it really didn't capture the imagination of most Americans because it didn't answer the question why this is important. But he's got to do it in a way that it does not fearmonger. And I think that's the thing with this president, is that he's much more balanced. He's very deliberative. So what I think we're looking for tonight is some clarity that puts this threat in perspective, that demonstrates that it's a long-term battle, and demonstrates that the Americans won't have to pay the costs, the extensive costs that were associated with the previous decade and all of those mistakes like the Iraq War. And it's a difficult balancing act, but I think given where the public mood is after this summer and the killings of these journalists, I think he has an opportunity to really lead and change the mindset and how we think about these issues.
Brian, this is a question that we should do a whole hour on, but since we are on the eve of the 13th anniversary of the September 11th attacks, is there any way to look at the so-called, you know, the war on terror, the war on terrorism then and now? Any way to judge whether we are winning it? Is it a draw? I'm thinking about Al-Qaeda. Yes, they probably aren't what they used to be, but they still exist.
This is the travesty that I think is the problem that America faces right now. 13 years after 9/11, we fundamentally don't have the answer to the question of, are we safer? We've expended literally trillions of dollars and thousands of lives. And if you ask senior officials, they have a sense of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula may be the leading threat. They have the sense that maybe some of those networks we tried to get at in Pakistan and Afghanistan are weaker. But we don't have that clarity of vision. And I think in part it's because so much of the strategy that's been applied has put the burden on the Pentagon, on the intelligence agencies. And for all of our talk of smart power, of using diplomacy, of using politics, Americans simply have not done that effectively enough yet.
Would that require then, I mean, are you talking about the State Department, more diplomacy, more State Department issues?
Yeah, but it's also not a government struggle. It's also for your listeners who work at universities or as businessmen in civil society. It's the things that, you know, our diplomats need to be empowered more, but our societies and the things that make, I think, America great and our openness and debate is often not in full display because what people see, as Rami has articulated, in the region, they often see, you know, predator drone strikes or they see our military force. And that, I think, is an important part of our power. But it's horribly incomplete if we don't have those other aspects.
Well, on that note, we have to end our discussion with the two of you. Brian Katulis, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Rami Khoury, thank you for joining us as well.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. He's with the American University of Beirut, also editor-at-large and columnist at the Beirut-based Daily Star newspaper. Jonathan Wiseman, waiting in the wings, New York Times congressional reporter, talking about Obama's talk yesterday with congressional leaders. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia opens its 50th anniversary concert season on September 14th and 15th at the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts. Music director Dirk Brasset conducts the orchestra in beloved works by Verdi and Beethoven and welcomes pianist Dee Wu for Mendelssohn's Piano Concerto No. 2. Tickets available now at chamberorchestra.org or 215-893-1709. That's chamberorchestra.org or 215-893-1709.
This Week in This American Life.
You got to tighten up your story.
Our longtime producer, Alex Blumberg, is trying to start his own business, and he is recording the entire awkward process, like when a billionaire investor who he's pitching gives up any pretense that he might invest and just starts coaching him.
Well, start again. You're uniquely positioned to do it because you're better at it than anybody?
Yeah, I am.
I apologize for that.
Yeah. This Week.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. You know the type, the guy who sees the merge right sign on the highway and stays in the left lane anyway to cut ahead.
While everybody else who's already in the lane that has merged looks to their left and growls and grimaces. But as it turns out, there are a lot of people who think that you actually should go all the way to the end.
That's the zipper merge. Then there's the jerk merge. We'll debate both next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. President Obama met yesterday with congressional leaders to talk about his strategy to stop the advance of ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. He also calls them ISIL. And as we all know, he'll be giving a speech tonight, talking to the American public at 9 o'clock about his strategy. And we asked Jonathan Weissman to join us. He's a New York Times congressional reporter. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
I'm happy to be here.
So what did the president and the congressional leaders, what did they talk about yesterday?
They talked about what President Obama will talk about tonight, which is how he plans to confront ISIS or ISIL, and what he wants from them, which is not very much. He does not want to repeat what happened a year ago when he came to Congress looking for authorization to strike Syria and the Assad regime for going over his red line on chemical weapons, only to be rebuffed. That was one of the most embarrassing moments of his presidency, certainly of his foreign policy. So he told them that he believes that he has the authority to expand strikes against ISIS even into Syria. He does not need that. He also said he would not be asking for more money right away. This actually is probably what congressional leaders want. They want to talk tough, but they don't actually want to take a vote.
Hmm. Do they want the president, I mean, in a sense, to do the dirty work? I mean, if it succeeds, that's fine. If it fails, it's his problem?
Well, as one congressman told me, Jack Kingston of Georgia said that he favors taking an authorization vote. But he said for both parties, what's best is to do nothing. The Democrats aren't sure how their base voters are going to respond to another expansion of military action in Iraq. And Republicans, you know, would rather sit on the sideline, and if it goes well, they'll praise him and say, hey, what took him so long? It was his fault in the first place. If it goes well, badly, they can just razz him on it. And the status quo is perfect for them, because if they have to vote, they think their fingerprints are on the issue.
Does the president, though, have the authority, whether it's through the War Powers Resolution or either or under the authorization for use of military force, which Congress passed shortly after September 11th?
The authorization of military force after September 11th is remarkably broad and has been used, obviously, by President Bush and President Obama continuously to expand the war on terror. It hasn't been challenged, so I think he probably does have that authority. There are bipartisan voices in Congress that say that resolution, which is obviously now almost 14, 13 years old, right, should be repealed and a more tailored resolution be adopted. Those voices haven't gotten very far. And then the War Powers Act has also been very nebulous. I mean, ostensibly, 60 days after the beginning of military action, he is supposed to get a declaration of war from Congress. But President Obama keeps basically resetting the clock on this by sending a new letter to Congress every few days, saying, "All right, I've begun a new action in Iraq. I've begun a newer action," and you know, it can be just on bombing over at the Haditha Dam. It can be bombing to break the siege of the Yazidis. Every time he comes up with a new rationale, the White House thinks they're resetting the clock, and they have another 60 days.
Wow. The president uses words like degrade and destroy. He doesn't use the word war. Do you think that's significant?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that even members of Congress feel like it's hard to declare war on ISIS. You're not declaring war on a sovereign country with a government. You're declaring war on this amorphous blob, this mass. I mean, right now, what we're doing is bombing our own military equipment. Whenever you get another email from Central Command about the destruction of ISIS Humvees, you're talking about Humvees that the United States gave to the Iraqi government. So it is an odd situation and really unprecedented.
I also thought it was odd to compare the kind of language that Vice President Joe Biden has been using, talking about the gates of hell. And, of course, President Obama doesn't talk that way. But do you think they're playing a kind of good cop, bad cop, or a cool cop, excitable cop?
You know, it's interesting you ask that because, you know, early in the administration, we might have wondered if how planned Vice President Biden's speeches are. But I think by now we realize that they're not always very planned.
Okay.
And I cannot be sure that Vice President Biden is following some kind of script or just speaking the way the Vice President speaks. So I don't think so. Now, President Obama, of course, has gotten into trouble with things that he said in the past. He called ISIS a JV team. And he has talked about having no strategy to deal with the situation. He keeps kind of putting his foot in it, and I think that one of the things that members of Congress are going to be looking for, especially Democrats in Congress and the Democrats in the Senate, is some more resolute, forceful language. They would like the country to rally around its commander-in-chief, but they can only do that, voters can only do that if they feel like they're being rallied.
We have a tweet from ATP says, ISIS should have been destroyed when it invaded Iraq from Syria. Wouldn't that have been taking sides and just defending the border? I mean, this is, you know, obviously with the advantage of hindsight. But as you said, Obama kind of dismissed ISIS a couple of months ago or back in the winter. And now tonight he's going to do a speech about them.
Oh, that's right. And remember also at that time, Iraq was kind of in the throes of a political crisis. The United States had really begun working against the Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and wanted a new government in. I think striking ISIS at that point, the administration would be backing the wrong horse, which is Maliki. Now that they have gotten a new government and a new Prime Minister in Iraq, the administration feels politically freer to stand by the government in Baghdad, because the one that in some ways started all of this, Maliki's government, which has been very brutal toward the Sunnis, is now vanquished.
Jonathan, you wrote about the fact that Dick Cheney was also, I guess, talking to members of Congress yesterday about the threat of ISIS. What is that about?
It is an amazing thing. there is a singular lack of irony on Capitol Hill right now.
Right.
I mean, here we are about to go back, expand our military actions in Iraq, into Syria. A lot of the leaders of ISIS were actually former Iraqi military men under Saddam Hussein, who were captured and held in U.S. jails during the invasion of Iraq. But Cheney didn't actually come up here to talk about Iraq and ISIS. He came up to Capitol Hill and he gave a speech this morning to talk about the degradation of the U.S. military. And it was more aimed at the divisions within the Republican Party and this nascent isolationism and libertarianism than it was actually about Obama. What he's trying to do is get his party, the Republican Party, to resume the forceful interventionist foreign militarism that he backed when he was vice president, and not embrace, you know, the Rand Paul school, which is trying to pull back from that and be less entangled in the world at large.
What a difference 13 years makes. That's Jonathan Weissman, a New York Times congressional reporter. We are talking about the fact that President Obama will be speaking tonight about a strategy that he believes can deal with the threat of ISIS. He was talking with members of Congress, leadership members of Congress, yesterday about his strategy. And again, any questions or comments, you can join our conversation, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Jonathan, how much do you think the midterm elections, which are about 2 months away, are sort of either hanging over whatever the president says or even the response from members of Congress?
I don't think they're hanging very much over what the president says. I think that quietly both parties are already gearing up to use this. Scott Brown, who's running, the former Massachusetts senator, who's running against Jean Shaheen in New Hampshire now to become the senator from New Hampshire, he's already advertising on ISIS, blaming Obama. Wow. And kind of, now, a lot of Republicans are using this to say that the president is weak, he's feckless, he's not a strong leader. It underscores their contention that the administration is just not competent. The Democrats also look at this and think, well, maybe we have a last-ditch chance at rallying Americans around their commander-in-chief and buoying his approval ratings, because historically, midterm elections are most determined by a president's approval ratings, and obviously with the president around 41-42% approval, or even lower, that bodes very badly for Democrats. So there's no possible way that you could be this close to an election and not be looking at it politically. I think the administration, you know, much to Democrats' chagrin in some ways, never looks very politically at these things. They're just moving forward in the way that the president wants to, which is very deliberately, and for a lot of Democrats, nerve-wrackingly,
deliberately. This was a question I put to our previous guests, and we were talking about ISIS in the region, in the Middle East. It looks like there is, at least today, largely popular support for some kind of military strike to deal with ISIS among the American people. But the question is, and the president seemed to indicate, is that whatever the U.S. does, it's not going to be, you know, a week or two. It could be months and probably years. And I guess the question is, and there's no way to know the answer to this, but will the U.S. continue to support some kind of military action in the Middle East, knowing, of course, the history and the Iraq War and all of that?
That is a very good question, because there's certainly, even among Republicans, a real war weariness. I was talking to one of the more libertarian-minded House members, Thomas Massie from Kentucky, very closely aligned with Ron and Rand Paul, who said, look, for him to vote to authorize war, he would have to be convinced that somehow this third war in the Middle East would end up differently from the first two wars, which he does not think ended up well. So I think that there would be, as long as this is a distant air war, like right now, Americans aren't that tuned in. They're happy that I think that the administration is striking at ISIS, and it's not particularly impinging on our lives domestically. But if this goes on, and certainly if it becomes a ground war, this is going to become very, very controversial.
I mean, the president has said no boots on the ground. He's made previous promises in the past. Do you think he can promise that?
I think he will promise that, and what he hopes, and what members of Congress really hope, especially Democrats, is that there will be boots on the ground eventually, but they will not be American boots. I spoke with Nancy Pelosi yesterday, who's saying what she really wants most is to hear from the president that he has attained firm commitments from NATO to help out. A lot of members of Congress want to see, they say this is a Sunni Muslim problem. They want to see Sunni forces on the ground. They want to see ground troops from Turkey. They want to see Air Force resources from Saudi Arabia. They want to see the kind of coalition that George H.W. Bush was able to put together for the first Gulf War. And so far, President Obama's been having a hard time getting back those kinds of commitments.
How much do you think the just horrific beheading of the two American journalists by ISIS, how much do you think that got the president to deal so directly and in prime time, which he will do tonight, on this issue of and this threat of ISIS?
I think that there's no doubt that it had a huge impact. For one thing, journalists cover each other. It was a shock to the journalism world, and the journalism world suddenly became very attuned to what was going on. That obviously thrust the issue in front of the public. And you know, there was a real sense of revulsion, not just because that these were Americans, but the sense that ISIS made a threat. They said they were going to do this, and then they did it. And it made the ISIS threat appear and feel credible.
The other thing, too, in that threat was whoever was doing the beheading, or the person whose face we couldn't see, was goading Obama. He called him Obama.
That's right. And he put the two American journalists into orange jumpsuits to look to look like Guantanamo detainees. He spoke with an English accent. They obviously were pushing a lot of buttons here.
Well, I thank you, Jonathan Weissman, for joining us today on Radio Times and getting us, I guess, ready for tonight's speech by President Obama. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And he's New York Times congressional reporter. And we began our conversation talking with Rami Khoury from the American University of Beirut, also editor-at-large and columnist at the Beirut-based Daily Star newspaper. We also spoke with Brian Katul, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. And yes, we've done a number of shows about ISIS and the threats posed by ISIS in the Middle East. And we'd love to hear from you if you send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also leave a post on our Facebook page and send us a tweet as well. I'm Marty Moscow, and thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.